Welcome to Brain Body Movement, a series of talks based on a lecture series of the same title. The talks will be done in a more informal style, so you may wish to consult the printed texts, which are made available to you on my website, www.sam-gill.com. I hope you enjoy the talks. Thank you. Human life, from Genesis to Gross National Product, is about making an agency, an action that lead us to having stuff. Human beings are concerned about making themselves, making others, making stuff, making others make stuff that makes more stuff. The measure of the man is how many toys he has, how much money he makes, how much agency he commands, how much power he has to make others make stuff for him. That is, one stuff is what it is all about. Money is both a measure and an exchange of our making, our agency, our power, our wealth, our self-worth. The question, how much money does she make, is to invoke a medium that embraces all these related terms. The current world crisis is a crisis of food and health care and education and global warming and international relations and terrorism and security and opportunity. How does the new president address all these issues? By infusing money and in terms of budgets. In the words of that great song in the musical Cabaret, money makes the world go round, the world go round, the world go round. To attend to these things is nothing new. Yet, every time I read Elaine Scarry's book, The Body in Pain, I am surprised at how deeply making and unmaking are related to the human body and how long this relationship has existed. It is fascinating to think about how all making is, in some important sense, motivated by some lack of the body, by some projection of the body into the world beyond the body. And thus the motivation, the agency for making, rests in part on pain, on the desire to alleviate pain and discomfort. It is a crazy insight to recognize that all made things are, in some sense, patterned on the body, or at least our idea of what a body should be. It is important that we realize that in making stuff, we are remaking ourselves. I find insightful Scarry's discussion of the hinge effect of made things. We make things as projections for our bodies or our image of what our bodies should be. These made things, standing seemingly independent of us in the world outside our bodies, then return the favor, exercising an agency projected on them and, in turn, remake us. We must spend some quality time reflecting on the multiplier and exchange effect of made things. The energy and effort required to make a thing is multiplied by its impact on us and those around us as it hinges back to show us what we did. Scarry's analysis of the impact of the small effect and movement required to pull the trigger of a gun is far out of proportion with the potential impact the fired gun has on the world. Of course, to make a gun, from the inception of the idea of such a device, through a history of development and design and manufacture and distribution, is a long and complex one. Yet we can see that in making, there is often a powerful multiplication of the hinged return. In the evolution of human beings, the development of the thumb is, as Frederick Engels noted, of critical importance. Without a thumb, we cannot easily hold tools to make things to hold and exchange. The thumb is surely also the inspiration for all our interest in holding, grasping, clasping, handedness, specialization, even of our brain hemispheres, weapons, handshakes, and masturbation, although the thumb is here important to males, not females. In turn, the thumb is the culprit in loss and losing. We measure value in terms of the direction of the thumb. Thumb up is winner, down is loser. Ecologists and evolutionists have long known that the opposing thumb is a distinctive mark of humans. I'll return to the thumb later. Scarry's location of making in Jewish and Christian biblical literature is fascinating and actually jarring, I think. The biblical passages of God making the world and human beings, the passages of human beings making images of God and his response all seem rather shocking in the degree to which the making and unmaking of the body is involved. I find it rather surprising to think about how extensively involved is the body of God and humans in this formative exchange, in a religious tradition seemingly so opposed to the body, it shocks us to find that important exchanges between God and humans, as depicted by biblical literature, were about bodies. Yet even here I feel slightly embarrassed that these ideas surprise me. After all, God is traditionally thought of in male-gendered terms. God from the get-go is a speaker, and speech is physically a bodied action, and language, as we have learned, makes sense only in bodied terms. God's initial statement, "Let there be light," is clearly a projection into a made world of bodily attributes, specifically that there are bodied eyes to see. Our images of Adam and Eve are images of naked and gendered bodies. Among the first acts of these ancient parents were their making of garments to cover their genitalia. As we reflect on these first makings, we begin to realize that this action is exemplary of all that has followed. God, too, created human beings in his own image, as Scripture tells us. Thus, God's creation of the world must surely be motivated in some way, as is human making, that is, out of pain and desire according to one's own nature. The Christian innovation was to take the embodiment of God all the way to incarnation, to give God a human body, a male one, of course, so that the drama could be played out in deeper, more profound, and more bizarre ways. Artifact, artifice. I like these words. Artifact refers to a human-made object, especially an object that is made with a view to subsequent use. Thus, the term artifact reflects Scarry's hinge effect of human making. We also think of artifact as the remains of such an object, a shard of pottery, for example, that reveals the makings of others. Artifact often implies made by hand, but can include mass production objects. And of course, artifact is human-made, not natural. Now, the term artifice is even more fascinating to me. The word has two primary meanings. The first suggests ingenuity and an artful stratagem. Artifice is cleverness and artful skill. However, the second use of the term suggests something more on the order of a trick, false or insincere behavior. Thus, artifice is a term that catches some interesting shades of value associated with making, the extension of our bodies, the manifestation of our body images, through ingenious artifact, creative extensions and projections, but also the falseness, the emptiness, the made-upness of objects and makings. In terms of art, the term artifice catches the interplay between the object made to cleverly reflect back on the world and the obvious yet often unacknowledged fact that art is made up, a trick, a lie. Scarry boldly describes God as the original artifact, suggesting a projection of the human body on the prime agent who then returns the favor. Another energy I find in the word artifice is that it suggests in its mixture of values and indeterminacy that accompanies making, that is, the relationship between maker and thing made. Thing made is a projection of the body. Thing made hinges back to remake the maker. In neurology, I think this would be considered a feedback loop. The indeterminacy in the understanding of where lies the agency, who indeed is in control. The indeterminacy is in the understanding of where lies the agency, who indeed is in control. Negatively, we may feel overwhelmed. Positively, we may enjoy the creative play. From a theological point of view, these concerns may suggest the endless question of the presence of free will. In the terms of human sciences, we may think of the issue primarily in terms of agency. And we may be surprised to learn, as considered by Sean Gallagher, that this has also been an issue of neuroscience. I actually think that the discussion here is a bit silly. Neuroscientists such as Benjamin Libet have shown that our actions are often initiated by neurological processes that occur well before the actor has an awareness of even the intention of such actions. On the basis of this demonstration, some have argued for a pure determinism. I suppose this means that we are but mechanistic, programmed beings whose every action is a reaction to the world around us based on neurologically determined patterns set through human evolution, that nothing we do is a result of our willful determination. Gallagher reframes the matter into larger than microsecond intervals to argue for agency and willfulness. What is clear is that human beings are remarkably complex and invariably distinctive as comprised of a number of complex interacting systems, some totally hardwired, yet many malleable by culture and individual agency and action. We must thank God, who we now know had a body and needed to think about all these things, that we don't have to consciously direct our every motor function. Had we to live this way, we would spend most of the morning just grasping a cup of coffee, getting the coffee into our bodies, and processing the liquid to extract the caffeine. Swimming happily around in the lake of making an artifice, we encounter splashing around, making far too many waves for our comfort, a rather odd Frenchman, obscure, bold, almost downright nasty, spewing about pornography and gendered values and production and, frankly, God knows what. Surely were he to let us, we'd simply swim on by. Yet if we tread water nearby, we may experience something on the scale of a tsunami. I've read at Jean Baudrillard many times, not only his book Seduction, but many of his others. Each reading has a different effect on me. This time through this section of his book, I was pretty constantly irritated by him, not yet sure why. Still, I cannot help but feel a powerful impact from some of what I think he may be saying. In terms of our present topic of making an agency and power and production, I am caught, abducted in Peirce's terms, by his introduction of a contrast between production and seduction. It is an amazingly rich and provocative, yet difficult and opaque idea. Let me just note a few things Baudrillard seductively writes about seduction and production. Here I'm just going to quote a number of passages from him. The first one is, "All masculine power is a power to produce. The only and irresistible power of femininity is the inverse power of seduction. In itself, it is null. Seduction has no power of its own, only that of annulling the power of production. But it always annuls the latter." The second passage, "It is femininity that incarnates reversibility, the possibility of play and symbolic involvement." The third passage, "Seduction is an ironic alternative form, one that breaks the referentiality of sex and provides a space not of desire, but of play and defiance." The fourth Baudrillard passage is, "Seduction is stronger than power because it is reversible and mortal, while power, like value, seeks to be irreversible, cumulative, and immortal. Power partakes of all the illusions of production and of the real. It wants to be real and so tends to become its own imaginary, its own superstition, with the help of theories that analyze it, be they to contest it. Seduction, on the other hand, is not the order of the real and is never of the order of force nor relations of force. But precisely for this reason, it enmeshes all power's real actions as well as the entire reality of production in this unremitting reversibility and disaccumulation, without which there would be neither power nor accumulation." And the final passage from Baudrillard, this is from his book Seduction. "Seduction is stronger than production. It is a circular, reversible process of challenges, one-upmanship, and death." Perhaps it is not easy to clearly understand Baudrillard on seduction, yet, as he shows us, the grasping for clarity and finality for the end of play, as Derrida once put it, is masculine, and this drives production. Still, exerting our masculinity a bit, this is in some sense the problem of Archimedes, who declared, "Give me a place to stand and I'll move the world." Power, the power to make, cannot simply exist sufficiently of itself. Power can be only if there is something other than, outside of, power. This alternative to power must, itself, not be power or powerful. Yet as Baudrillard writes, without this alternative, there would be neither power nor accumulation. We desperately want to grasp, using our thumbs, this alternative, yet Baudrillard makes it difficult for us. He calls it seduction. It can be neither thing nor force. He describes it, insofar as he does so, as reversibility, as circular, we might say oscillatory, as play, as defiance, as outside reason and desire and force. Seduction is stronger than production. Seduction is feminine. Production is masculine. Trying to understand seduction reminds me a bit of that story of the Iroquois woman who, after listening to a lecture on relativity and cosmology, told the scientist that the Iroquois world was created on the back of a tortoise. The scientist, amused by her remark, asked, "But what does the turtle rest on?" She quickly and confidently answered, "It's turtles all the way down." Does it matter at all that production, power, agency are of value only in their also existing an alternative? Baudrillard understands our world as production run amok, that making and the hinged effects of the made on the maker have become so accelerated, so rampant, that there has finally come to be no grounding at all. All is feedback. Humans are as much artificial, clever, and false as what they have made. Humans are as much or more products of what the world has produced as they are producers of the things in the world. In his view, all has become hyper-real, more than real, real to such an extent that all of the distinctions have collapsed between real and unreal, maker and made. And in such a world, no wonder pornography is rampant, with male makers seeking some final evidence through an ultra-close-up view that sex is real. As Baudrillard writes, "Pornography says there must be good sex somewhere, for I am its caricature. In its grotesque obscenity, it attempts to save sex's truth and provide the faltering sexual model with some credibility." For Baudrillard, the counterpart of pornography that exemplifies production is transvestitism, which he believes exemplifies seduction. Transvestitism is, in his view, not about gender and sexuality, but about the pure play of signs. It is about an endless interplay of appearances. Applied to the academic world, I think it is fairly clear that what we do is aligned with production, with the masculine. We interpret, we examine, we analyze, we provide answers, we create minds, we accumulate knowledge, we win football games. Though physically subtle, our makings are projections into the world of our ideal understandings of our minds. When we then see these productions, especially in the form of writing, they reveal much to us. They express what we desire to be the character of our minds. Academic writing conventions and practices produced by the mind are a hinge that helps create the mind. The desired distinctions are clarity, objectivity, finality, orderliness, sensibility, authority, power, concreteness, innovation, creativity, and enduring in plain black and white. Given the recent studies of the brain and its propensity to clever artifice, our brains, our body minds, are anything but distinguished by the qualities of our writings. Academic work may then be seen as the masculine attempt to produce a mind quite different from what we actually possess, a process motivated perhaps as much by anything as by the unmet desire to have such a mind, a desire that we have endeavored for centuries to produce by dismissing the body as of any but vehicular value. We still hope that the academic works we make will hinge back on us to give us a kind of minds we desire, or perhaps academic products serve to fail our gut understandings of the actual workings of the mind. To finish what can never be finished, I want to take the discussion of making, action, artifice, production as background for thinking through things with which I am personally concerned. As you all know, I am fascinated with dancing. I think that we can understand some interesting things about dancing when seen in light of this discussion of making and production. Clearly, our culture devalues dancing, It is not a topic commonly taught in schools. It would be difficult to find anyone who would insist that we should spend money and time teaching dancing on a par with science and math, or even social studies and literature, or even art and music. Where does dance fit in a world directed by masculine, powerful production? The answer is simple. Dance is valued to the degree it is seen as masculine, powerful production. Yet what does dancing produce? In the most immediate sense, dancing produces nothing beyond the body of the dancers dancing. One certainly could argue that there is some existence of a dance beyond the dancing, say the classical ballet Sleeping Beauty. This may be true of choreographed art performance dancing, but it isn't for all the rest of the world's dancing. There is no parallel artifact like a play script for theater, no score as with music. Dance notation is not viable since it cannot be read or even seen. Dancing is distinguished for its relationship to making. It is a making where what is made is bodily identical with the maker. The dancer is the dance in some important respects. Where is the hinge? Where is the multiplier effect, especially for non-art, non-performance dancing? But what of dancing as art, as performance, as done for an audience, as a product of culture and high culture? Interestingly, such forms of dancing are usually uncomfortable products of masculine makings, even if done by male dancers. Notice the terminology that has come to be associated with these accepted forms of dance. They are done by companies of dancers. The company puts on productions. Choreographers typically refer these days to their creative process as making work. The results of choreography are themselves referred to as works. The economic side of this type of dancing is prominent. Audiences pay to watch. Programs tell audiences the meanings and stories of the dances. Advertising and promotion are extensive, and so on. Even with all these terminological adjustments and masculinizations to fit a world driven by productivity, dancing remains an uncomfortable fit. Few dance companies really make it. Few dancers actually earn a living. And notably, dancing, even of this type, is only rarely associated with masculinity and masculine sexuality. Baryshnikov is a rare exception. All this would seem depressing and hopeless, yet Baudrillard's work seems to offer some insight. Might we rethink dancing in terms of seduction? Could we comprehend dancing in these terms? Were dancing to be aligned with seduction as Baudrillard presents it, it would not be productive, nor would it necessarily have fixed meanings. It would not project something onto made objects to meet the desire caused by a lack. Dancing would be reversible and circular and mortal and powerless and without meaning. What could be more exemplary of reversibility than dancing, where the same object, the body, is maker and thing made, is dancer and dance? Yet, dancing would also be stronger than production, stronger for not having meaning, for not making anything, for not producing artifact. Dancing would be foundational in important ways to production. Dancing would be understood as perhaps the last surviving experience of the idea of reality in a world of hyper-reality. My work in developing dance theory moves in this direction. It takes stock of such cultural examples as the Hindu figure of Nataraja, whose dancing encompasses, but is not the producer of, creation, destruction, preservation, and materiality. Nataraja, whose dancing is understood as play or lila, as for nothing, as without meaning, yet stronger than all of these. My personal dance interest is not in performance, art, high cultural forms, but rather in social dancing. I want here to return to the thumb. Salsa, as most social dancing, is done by male-female partnering couples. The dance is based on a simple basic rhythm-patterned combination of steps. On this foundation, the improvisational dance is built, notice the language I'm making here, is built up from just a few conventional elements of movement. Traditionally, teaching the dance involves establishing the rhythm-patterned basic steps and then teaching combinations of the movement elements. In my teaching, the males, who are invariably the leads, are obsessed with learning moves. This is very consistent with the values of our society. The best dancers are those with the most moves, or so it seems most males believe. Moves are seen as external productions, actions intended to impress one's dance partner and, of course, make other males envious. In my experience, women, the follows, are mostly taught to anticipate the lead, often through rather obvious external signs, including even some guys' tendency to actually verbally tell the woman what he is about to do. Teaching in this way, which I did for many years, I was always shocked to see the results of my work. Good dancers I was rarely making. I was disturbed to see the jerky, conflicted, awkward, almost violent, and hurtful appearance of these dancers. I would see guys wrestle and drag their partners through some complex moves, awkwardly executed, and almost always lacking any connection with the rhythm and the music. Were I to consider this process in terms we have been discussing here, I'd have to say that this is masculine dancing oriented toward production. It is directed to making something to fulfill a felt lack, to meet an unmet desire. This kind of dancing as social dancing displaces social connection with demonstration, partnering with controlling and overpowering manipulation. It is male-centered despite the unnoticed fact that it is only the skill and intuition of the women that make it anything other than painful disaster. I shifted the way I teach a couple of years ago. While I still teach complex move patterns, I am a North American male, after all. I have begun to place a large amount of attention on partner connection. What I am interested in teaching is the skill of two people physically connecting through touch and many other connectivities. This is the sort of touching that is subtle, requiring only the lightest of physical contact, but where the two bodies are focused on the interconnection. The connection is one of equality of force and opposition, push against push, pull against pull. It is a skill that clearly works at the subconscious level and requires response times of nanoseconds. It is a connection that might be described as like a bungee cord because of the progressive increasing and decreasing forces that are exactly met by the two dancers. Here is where the thumb comes in again. In the male-dominating move-making style of dancing, men often connect with their partners by firmly holding their hands, using the thumb to assure the connection. Men dancing this way grasp their partners with their thumbs powerfully engaged so as to better control and use the woman as a tool of their exhibition. The use of thumbs in this context says it all. The innovation of technique I apply to teaching dancing is to never, well, almost never, allow the use of thumbs. Rather, the guy's middle fingertips are placed on the woman's palm where her middle finger meets her palm. Male middle finger are two to the middle of the female's inner hand without thumbs. The dancers must focus carefully on connection, maintaining a connection on connective interaction and movement. Leading and following must become interdependent, co-equal, interactive, subtle, sensitive. Leading and following require constant feedback, looping, or play. Touch and touching are the foundation of the connection. The resulting dancing is very different. The dance is focused primarily on the physical connection. Moves or movement combinations arise out of this connection rather than out of male productiveness. Sensitivity to the connection demands that the dancing is compatible with the experience both dancers have in connecting and maintaining the connection. Dancers trained in this way find the experience of dancing very different. Smooth, social, interactive, sensuous, playful, and, yes, seductive. Such an approach is also interesting from the perspective of making. While I have said that making dance, particularly in the non-art, non-performance sense of dancing, is when the thing made is the same as the maker, this reversibility is equivalent to the experience of what Baudrillard is referring to as seduction. Now, in the social dance setting, dance and dancer are two persons, not one. So what of the reversibility here? What is involved in the dance and dancer being one body? Well, when the dance is done with thumbs, with the masculine intent to produce, there is no reversibility. There is only the male thrusting forward, controlling the female, bent on showing, making, and pressing. However, without thumbs, the two move as one, with fluidity, with grace, with ease. There are two, Yet in their connection, they experience a oneness. They experience a reversibility. They play with one another without meaning or goal or product. Thank you for listening to this volume of Brain Body Movement, a series of talks based on a lecture series by the same title. I am making this lecture series in print form available to you on my website, www.sam-gill.com. Thank you very much for listening to this volume, and I'll be talking to you again later. Bye-bye.